Good morning to you all, and welcome to the sixth lecture of 2018 Palliative Care Lecture Series. Hospice NZ would like to thank and acknowledge Cancer Research Trust New Zealand for their generous support and funding to deliver free lectures. The lecture today will be recorded, and it will be available on the Hospice New Zealand website. Please be aware there will be an opportunity for questions at the end of the presentation. We would now like to introduce our guest speaker today, Professor John Swinton. He is a professor in practical theology and pastoral care at the University of Aberdeen. Welcome, John. Please go ahead.
Well, good morning, everybody, or good evening as it is here in sunny Scotland. And it is sunny Scotland for a change, which is quite nice. My name is John Swinton. I'm a professor in pastoral care at Aberdeen University. Before I get into the issues that I want to talk about, I should maybe tell you a little bit about where I've come from. So my background is in nursing. I worked for many years in the area of mental health, and then I retrained and worked in the area of intellectual disability. And I've also worked as a hospital chaplain with people living with dementia and also people living with a variety of different mental health challenges. So my thinking and the things that I wanted to talk about today come out of that background. Because one of the things that always fascinated me about dementia is just emerges kind of from where I've been, really. And, you know, back in the 80s and the 90s, they used to have these huge dementia wars, and that's what they called them, which is not the most pleasant way of putting it. But in there were people, you know, these wars would have maybe 30, 40 people, and people would get up in the morning, they'd put in front of the television set, they'd sit and watch kids' programs for most of the day, they'd have food, they'd be kept clean, and then they'd go back to bed again. And that was the kind of routine that people had. And what always struck me, though, was that although many people assumed that people with dementia in these contexts really weren't aware, weren't available in certain ways, it always struck me that when you begin to talk to people, spend time with people, when you begin to listen to music together and various other things, there's all sorts of really interesting things that begin to happen as people respond to music, respond to conversation, respond to touch. And so, although in these big wars, which are pretty unpleasant places where people were written off, if you get down to the ground and spend time with people, you see something else. And that experience really has stuck with me over the years and really shaped and reformed my understanding of what I think dementia is and how best we should be together with people who living with dementia. And so today I wanted just to think through some aspects of what dementia is and why some of the things that we assume about dementia are not quite as accurate as they seem to be. I begin to explore issues around memory, issues around the importance of our bodies, music, various other things. And at the end of the time, I wanted just to come together and think about what dementia is in the light of the kind of ideas I want to introduce. You'll have before you a series of slides, which I'll just move through. I'll just say slide number one, slide number two, whatever it is, and that way we'll all hopefully be in the same space. So slide number two. I'm very interested sometimes in how we come to get an imagination. You know, I don't know if you've thought about it, how important your imagination is for the way that you make sense of the light of the world. Your imagination contains the values, the expectations, the plausibility structure, the assumptions you have about the world. All of that information that helps you make sense of the world. And it would be very difficult, for example, to cross the road without having a certain kind of imagination that allows you to project into that situation and understand things according to certain rules and structures. But our imagination doesn't come to us from nowhere. We're taught how to imagine things. So all the powerful voices within our society tell us the way things should be and tell us how we should understand things. And one of the big, powerful voices that tells us how to understand dementia and helps us to imagine dementia is biology and neurology and medicine. Because at one level, dementia is clearly neurological damage leading to certain cognitive issues, certain memory problems, behavioral, and so on and so forth. That's obviously the case. And the temptation would be to think that that's all it is. But if we reimagine dementia a little bit and allow ourselves to think slightly differently about what it is, then we might get to somewhere interesting. Slide number four. So the way I'd like us to be thinking about our bodies is like this. There's two dimensions that we can think about in relation to our bodies. There's the material body, which is a kind of physical thing, your flesh, your bones, your brain, and so on and so forth. And that, without that material body, we wouldn't be able to be in the world in any kind of meaningful sense. But in that sense, dementia is damage to the material body. But there's another dimension to the body, and that's what we might call our lived body. What happens when our material body enters into the world, enters into relationships, enters into society, and all of the experiences and relational connections that we make there? What happens then when the material body enters into the world of the lived body? Sometimes I think that society in particular assumes that dementia can only really be understood according to the material body. It's nothing but decline. And you can tell that in the way that people talk about people living with dementia. You know, they're not the person they used to be, he or she would never do that, and all that kind of negative talk, which seems to assume that if part of your material body is damaged, then there's not much point to anything else. Now, I read a paper the other day, and the gentleman writing the paper said something like, "Life without memory is no life at all." And I was thinking to myself, how would you know that? How could you possibly know that? And what you find is people project negativity onto people with dementia and assume that that's the way it must be, but it's not necessarily that way. So slide number five. Dementia is a culturally devalued condition. So clearly it's brain damage, but within our culture, brain damage has a very particular meaning. One of the things, this is slide number six, one of the things that two things that people living with dementia really do experience significantly. One is stigma and the other is loneliness. And these two things are actually quite closely connected. So let's begin with the issue of stigma. What is stigma? Stigma is a term that comes from the slave trade, whereby the slave master would buy a slave and then would put a mark on that slave. And immediately the slave was reduced to the size of that mark. So they were no longer a person, they no longer had any possessions, they were no longer human, they were simply that mark. And very often that kind of stigma is precisely what we as a society ascribe upon people with dementia. If you look at the language that people use in relation to dementia, it's sometimes very terrifying and very aggressive. And when you look at the statistics, people fear dementia more than they fear cancer. And one of the reasons for that is that they assume that if you have damage to your brain, you somehow lose yourself. And so with cancer, you can kind of be brave and you can fight it, but with dementia, you lose yourself, or so people tend to think. And so it becomes a condition that draws stigma and also a condition that is deeply devalued. Now think about it. How do you come to value something? And so I may have a wedding ring, which isn't particularly expensive, but for me, it's invaluable. Why is it invaluable? It's invaluable because I place value on it. In order to be valuable, somebody has to place value on you. A condition like dementia, which is highly stigmatized, very few people place value on it. And so therefore, people withdraw. So therefore, people with dementia become lonely. So devaluing, stigma, loneliness, all of these things run together simply because of the way that we think about dementia as part of your material body and the way that we frame dementia as part of a person's experience, a social experience. So slide number 7 points us to some of the reasons, some of the issues why this happens. Within our culture, we place a great deal of value on things like intellect and reason, quick thinking, and sharpness of thought. So Stephen Post, in his lovely book, The Moral Challenge of Alzheimer's, calls this attitude that Western cultures has, hypercognition, to value something according to intellect and reason, rather than to value according to community and love and relationships. So we tend to think that as long as you can think clearly, you are who you are. But as soon as you stop being able to do that, you cease to be who you are. And Stephen Post just says it's a profound mistake that Western cultures make. And it's captured in the language, it's captured in the way we respond, but it's something that we need to address and think about in relation to dementia in particular, but special care in general. So in slide number 8, we have an interesting quotation from a gentleman who actually lived with dementia, Bob DeMarco. He says, "I'm saddened when I hear these words. This is not the person I knew. These words objectify the person living with Alzheimer's. When you objectify a person, you dehumanize them. Once dehumanized, the person becomes a villain. And then you begin to see the way that our language captures that dehumanization. She's not the person that she used to be. I'd rather remember him the way that he was. But if she's not the person that she used to be, then who is she? And why would we care, and why would anyone love her? And if you'd rather remember them the way the person the way they were, then what does that say for the person that they are now in the present?" And so one of the primary things that we need to think about, I think, in relation to giving genuinely person-centered dementia care is the language that we use around people living with dementia. Because the language that we use creates the world that we think we see. So the way you talk about things expresses what you think that thing is that you're looking at. And what you think that thing is that you're looking at will determine how you respond to it. So if you use language like, "he's not the person he used to be," then that's what you'll see, and more than probably that's how you'll respond. So speaking properly about dementia, I think, is a fundamentally important beginning point. So let's think about speaking about dementia. In order to do that, I want us to move on to slide number 11 and to think about what it means to be you, what it means for us to be the people that we are. You know, on slide number 10, you can see that little phrase there, "is he the person he used to be." And that really sums up something very, very important about how many of us think about ourselves and how we come to be ourselves. So for many of us, to be a self is to remember things from the past, to be able to bring them into the present, and then project a possible future. And so our self is autobiographical, in the sense that we are who we are as long as we can tell our own story, as long as we can bring our story from the past into the present and project a possible future. As soon as you can no longer tell your own story, or as soon as you lose your autobiographical self, to put it a slightly different way, then people start to use that kind of language. He's not the kind of person that he used to be because he can't tell his own story. And then it also, you know, when people begin to be unable to recognize people or use language the way they used to do, then you get that reinforced that actually the person has somehow disappeared. But and we're moving on to slide 11. So there's a really interesting American psychologist that some of you may be familiar with called Stephen Sabat. And he wrote a book called Alzheimer's, the Tangled Web. But in that book, he did a fascinating piece of qualitative research with people living with dementia at various stages in their journey. So people who had just been diagnosed, but also people who were in quite advanced stages of dementia. And one of the powerful things that he discovers is that no matter where you are in your adventure journey, you still are able to communicate if people can find a way to communicate with you. But more than that, you always have a sense of who you are. So it may be that you use the wrong words, it may be that you use the wrong phrases and expressions, but actually the language that people even with advanced dementia use is significant. It tells you something about who they are. And so it's a great book. Now, what I want us to focus on here and just now is how Stephen Sabbat understands what it means to be yourself. So what I've said to you is that culturally, to be yourself is to be able to tell your own story, to narrate your own autobiography. Stephen Sabbat says, actually, there's a better way to think about it, a way that's much more compassionate and much more open to the experiences of people living with dementia. So he describes this as the threefold self. So there's three dimensions to the self, he says, that are fundamentally important for people to understand. Self number one occurs when we, as long as we can experience our sense of self in the world. So we don't have to be able to articulate that in the way we used to do, but we have to be able to experience it. So as long as you are awake and conscious, you have a sense of being in the world because you're sentient, you can feel and experience things no matter what happens. And so the most important dynamic aspect of that dynamic is that you never lose yourself. So you may have a lot of damage to your brain, you may have all sorts of problems, but he says you're secure in who you are as long as people recognize you as somebody that's experiencing things in the world. Self number two is a little bit more complicated. Self number two is your body, so your material body in that sense, your height, your weight, the color of your eyes, the color of your hair, and so on and so forth. But self number two, Stephen Sabbat says, is also a social self, or a social dimension to the self, to the lived body in that sense. So he says, in self number two, you become a father, a mother, sister, a brother, a banker, a nurse, social care. All these social roles accumulate around you to hold you in yourself in the self number two. And so it's a social self in some sense. It includes the body, but it's also a social self. Now, within that, he says, you're always having to negotiate your story. So people will tell you certain things about your story, who you are, which may be true, but which may be false. But if somebody tells you something that's false, then you can tell a different story to counter that. And so you hold yourself in the midst of this complicated matrix of stories that goes on that helps us to hold on to ourselves. However, he points out, if you, in that context, get a diagnosis of dementia, then self too becomes quite problematic because people will say things to you about you that may not be true, and as soon as you try to tell a counter narrative, people will say, oh no, it's just a dementia. So you can no longer lose your keys, it's just a dementia. You can no longer forget to write something down, it's just dementia. So the danger Stephen Sabbat says with that self number two is even though you're able to articulate yourself, able to tell a different story, because this label of dementia is so powerful and so stigmatic, it tends to be difficult for a person to overcome so that their voice is heard. And so the danger there is people's voices begin to get lost simply because they have a diagnosis of dementia. Not because of anything they necessarily do, but the diagnosis itself points people in a certain direction. But then he says self number three. Now, self number three becomes really complicated for people with dementia because self number three is the self that's given to you in community. The self number three is completely dependent on people giving you the gift of friendship, of support, of love, of value, of dignity. You can't give these things to yourself. They're always gifted to you by other people. So friendship, love, value, dignity, these are things that people have to give to you. Most of us, most of the time, assume that our community has given that to us, But when it comes to self number three for people with dementia, Stephen Sabat says, it's very difficult for them to find these things. Because what tends to happen is, as soon as a person gets a diagnosis of dementia, the social structure falls away. The friendships fall away. Relationships fall away. And they find themselves isolated and find it really difficult to find sources of value. Because culture wants things like intellect and reason to be prioritized. And these are the very things that people living with dementia very often are losing. So Stephen Sabat says that in that self three dimension, it is possible to lose yourself, but only if your community abandons you. And that's really, really important, because what he's saying is that all of us together need one another to hold on to ourselves, particularly in self three, but to some extent all these things. But for many people with dementia and the value condition, it's that kind of holding is no longer available. And so he puts forward a different way of thinking about who we are. So if culture is saying, I think, therefore I am, i.e. everything that's important goes on in the brain, the way that Sabat is thinking, he says, is closer to the kind of African Ubuntu theology, where, this is slide number 12, I am because you remember me. We come and stay who we are because other people remember us. In other words, I become who I am because of you, not because of me. And so you get that sense of the self as interconnected within community, and that interconnection is fundamentally important for holding on to who we are. That's the same for all of us, but it just becomes really, really problematic for people with dementia because of this kind of cultural difficulty. But even, you know, something as apparently biological as memory runs along a similar train of thought. So if you think about memory, as I'm sure you know, is kind of a fragile thing, and we don't remember in the way that a computer remembers. We're always creating our memories in different ways. But I don't know if you've ever thought about it, but our memories are very often not held within our heads. Very often they're held within our communities. So for me, as an example, if I want to remember anything about my childhood, I have to go and ask my mum, because I can't remember for the life of me what I was like when I was 4 or 5, and then she tells me what I was like, and I trust her. That was what I was like. Right? But if she dies, and she will do one day, then probably a lot of my childhood memories will have gone, because they're not held by me, they're held by other people. And when you think about it, a lot of our memory sits outside of ourselves in that way. I mean, if you're writing something down just now, or if you have a computer or an iPad or an iPhone, all of these are places where your memories are stored. The key question is not so much how can I hold on to my memories if I get dementia, an important question. A key question for all of us is, who will hold our memories well when we can no longer remember ourselves? I think that's a really deep question. Who will hold your memory well when you can no longer remember it yourself? And so our communities are really, really important, not just in terms of social support, but actually in terms of holding memories that we cannot hold ourselves. I have a friend who doesn't have dementia at this moment in time, but she's creating a memory box. And in that memory box, she's putting all sorts of things, including the kind of music that she wants to be played to her if she ever does get dementia. So in that box, she's got Led Zeppelin and Deep Purple and all sorts of heavy metal music. And the reason she's put that in there is because she's terrified in case people will play Scottish country dance music to her all day long in whatever facility she ends up in. And there's a great wisdom in that, that you want to anticipate not what people think that elderly Scottish people should be listening to or thinking, but actually what the individual does. So thinking about memory is something that is stored and created and held by our communities. And that big question, which is slide number 13, who will remember you well when you have forgot yourself is really, really important. Slide number 14 simply relates to fear. Because one of the fears that people have is whether they can trust services to look after them when they find themselves vulnerable. And I think it's a good question. When whatever facilities we all work in or whatever situations we all work in, do people trust us to remember them well? Do people trust us to take the time to look, to touch and feel and to sense where we are now, where we've been in the past and where we're going to in the future? Do our facilities, whatever that may be, actually think about the future? One of the things that I notice in contemporary dementia care, quite rightly sometimes, is the emphasis on something like reminiscence, which is great, to be able to bring something from the past into the present and to help people to remember things that were pleasant at one point in their lives. That's great. But the problem with reminiscence is sometimes we can be so busy looking backwards that we forget that perhaps people living with dementia have a future. And perhaps as well as bringing things from the past into the present, we should also be thinking about the much more challenging question in some senses of what it means for a person with dementia to have a future, to have something to look forward to have something to move into rather than something to move backwards to. And that's a real challenge in some ways. But I think if we think that way, and if we think of dementia as not simply a downward decline towards death, but the possibility of an upward decline, an incline towards spirituality, that which gives meaning to your life, that which lifts your spirits, then it opens up another range of possibilities for interesting things. The next thing I wanted to think about is slide number 15, which has to do with memory again, but this time the memory of our bodies. So I began by telling you that my journey into dementia, into the experience of dementia, began in one of these big dementia wards, as they were called then. And I don't like using that expression, so forgive me, but you know what I mean. And that whole way in which people come into the room in different ways when they hear music and sounds and smell and things. Well, I worked for quite some time as a hospital chaplain, and I was always fascinated by that that movement. So I'd go into the ward, and I would pray with people, or I would sing with people, or I would do whatever spiritual things I would do, and people would just come into the room and really be present in ways that they simply weren't at other times. And I remember, you know, the psychologist, my psychologist colleagues would say things like, well, it's just well-ingrained memory, that they practice these things over time, and now it's not particularly meaningful. But I was never convinced about that. And so when I began to do formal research into dementia, I began to look into this idea of the memory of the body. And it's really fascinating. So we tend to think that most of our memory is recall memory, just the kind of autobiographical memory I was talking about earlier on. But actually something like only 95% of what human beings do is done consciously. Most of what we do just rumbles along under the bonnet. Yet we tend to focus on this 5% of awareness and memory that's culturally very important, but in terms of the overall experiences that we have, they're not quite so important. And so what I learned in relation to the memory of the body is that as people engage, if you can imagine this scenario, right? Me as a chaplain, and then people with advanced dementia responding to the things that I'm doing or singing or thinking about. In relation to body memory, this is kind of how it works. Over time, these people have engaged in a variety of spiritual practices. So they'll maybe pray, they'll sing, they'll do things that people do in a religious context. And their bodies have learned that over time. And now when they can no longer cognate in the way that they used to do, the body still remember. And so you, when you watch somebody moving like that, you're seeing a different kind of memory. You're seeing memory worked out in the present rather than worked out in the past. So when people engage in these movements and actions, they're meaningful, they're intentional, they're part of their, if you like, their spiritual development. And it's that idea that they're intentional is very important, because they're not like a reflex. It's actually intentional. And one good, interesting way to draw that out is to go to slide 17. I'll come back to slide 16 in a minute. But to go back to slide 17, and the issue of music. Right, so here I am. I am a guitar player, amongst other things. And I play my guitar, and suddenly these guys start to sing along with me and move along with me. Like that. I think to myself, well, what's going on there? Oliver Sacks, in a really interesting book called Musicophilia, Oliver Sacks is a neurologist who writes in some detail about strange neurological conditions that he encounters. And on this occasion, in this book called Musicophilia, he's talking about strange neurological conditions that involve music. And so in the last chapter of that book, he talks about Alzheimer's and music. It's a great chapter. And he points out that sometimes when people with dementia, the issue is not so much that they have forgotten certain things, although they clearly have, but that some memories are still present, but they're inaccessible because of the damage to the neurons and the synapses that prevent you from the person from actually accessing these memories. So the memory is still there, but you can't access it because the broken neurons. But the brain, as I'm sure you know, is plastic. It shapes and forms according to experience, and it's very clever and intricate. And if there's damage in one part of the brain, it tends to very often use other neural passages to get to damaged pieces, parts of the brain. And so in relation to music, he says, what very often happens is that music can be a bridge or a key. So it can enable you to bypass the normal neural pathways that you've been trying to use to get to this memory and access it via another pathway. And he says that that's what music does. It allows you to bypass broken neurology, use other neurological pathways and access the memory. So when you see people singing, for example, whatever it is they may be singing, they're singing because that music more than probably has opened up another neural pathway that allowed a person to access something that's going on there. Now, when you hear music, you don't just hum along. You don't just sing along. You actually have memories. You're taken to a time and a place and people and experiences and relationships. And a sense of who you were that simply is not available for other moments in time. And so when you capture somebody in that situation, the key for good dementia care, I think, is to learn how to be in that moment. Because in that moment, that person is engaging with something, some memory, some experience, in a way that he or she cannot do at another moment in time. And so while the music plays, this space of memory and experience opens up. But as soon as the music stops playing, then that experience goes. And so it's that idea that we as carers need to learn how to be in the moment, how to capture these moments without being cynical about them, and how to join with people as they engage with these moments. And you know, I'm talking about music, but anybody who's worked with people living with dementia will have had these experiences where suddenly you lock into somebody, or they lock into you in a way that they just simply haven't done it and don't do it any other time. And you know that something else is happening there, whether it's what's happening immediately in the room, or whether your presence reminds the person of something else or someone else or somewhere else. But there's an engagement there that is powerful. I think the essence of good dementia care, actually good spiritual care, is learning to be in the moment and to slow down and take time to notice those things that if we're moving too quickly, simply won't notice. So when you begin to look at dementia in that slightly different way, that your bodies remember things, that people have moments like that we are invited to join with them, when we begin to think that dementia is clearly biological damage, but also there's something spiritual, there's something lived within their experience, then a range of options for being alongside people living with dementia is increased. And so there's only a couple of things that I want to talk to you about, but there's one story that I'd like to share with you, simply because I think it's an interesting story. This is going to slide number 16. So my one of my good friends is a chaplain who works alongside people living with dementia. Excuse me. And she told me the story the other day about an experience that she had recently with a woman with advanced dementia called Beatrice. And so Beatrice was in her early 90s. She was very withdrawn and rarely communicated at any level. But my chaplain friend decided to go and speak to Beatrice. So she went to sit beside Beatrice, and she said, "Beatrice, I'd like to pray with you." And Beatrice didn't say anything. And so the chaplain began to pray. She went to take her through the Lord's Prayer. So she said, "Our Father." And as soon as she said, "Our Father," Beatrice started to pray. And then she prayed and she prayed and she prayed and she prayed. And she prayed for about 15 minutes. And eventually the chaplain had to stop her. But she clearly wasn't going to stop. And so she said amen, and the prayer stopped. But my chaplain friend was quite mystified by this, because here's a woman who, for all intents and purposes, makes no real contribution to conversations or relationships, and yet, given the opportunity, and given the, if you like, the opening up of a spiritual key for her, she clearly had something to offer. Now, the chaplain has no idea what she was saying. But that doesn't mean to say that what she was saying was irrelevant. It simply meant that the chaplain, in that situation, had to give her the gift of time. And so simply by giving her the gift of time, by opening up that space of surprise for Beatrice, she discovered something that actually nobody knew, that Beatrice was somebody who prayed, somebody who liked to do these things. And, of course, that changed everybody's perception of what was going on, and people were then able to think through certain strategies in relation to spiritual care. So the moral of that story really is, give people the benefit of the doubt. Never assume that people are unable to do things in a way that closes your mind, closes your imagination to the possibility that actually they can perhaps do much more than they appear to be. So that little quotation in slide 16 from Jean Vanier is nice. He says, "The heart is the deepest, most fundamental aspect of the human being that's touched and transformed by the Spirit." Now, Vanier is saying is really that within our culture, we talk a lot about the importance of the head. But he's saying, actually, maybe if we started thinking about the importance of your heart, you know, that place of relationship, that place of being together, kind of like that African Ubuntu model I gave to you earlier on, "I am because we are." If we began to think in that way, then our understanding of dementia begins to shift and change, because people don't disappear. Of course, there's space for grief, and of course, there's profound change, but people don't disappear. If we look at them properly, there's always something hopeful that we can begin to look into. And so, finally, before we have some questions, I wanted to take you through slide number 20. So, we've been through a number of different dimensions of what dementia is. Dementia is a meaningful human experience, and it's really important that we hold on to that, because dementia is something that people live into. If it's a way of being in the world, it can be highly problematic, it can be full of grief and distress, full of happiness and joy, but it's always meaningful, it's never meaningless. Dementia is a new set of stories that can be told about someone, and I talked about that when I was talking about Stephen Sabat's threefold self. So dementia brings on a new set of stories. Very often these stories are negative. What I've tried to point you towards today is maybe if we read these stories slightly differently, you may find something positive. It's an opportunity to challenge our assumptions that human beings are defined by memory and intellect. It's an opportunity to learn how to care for one another better. It's an opportunity to challenge our assumptions that human beings are defined by memory and intellect. It's an opportunity to learn how to care for one another better. It's also a place of loss and sadness. So I don't mean to be romantic about it, because there's grief, there's loss, there's sadness, there's a need for lament. And finally, it's a neurological condition that affects memory, condition, cognition, behavior, and self-awareness. Now, the final slide there is a quotation from a theologian called Joseph Pieper, who wrote a really interesting book called Faith, Hope, and Love. And he was trying to work out, amongst other things, what love is. And it's a complicated question, but he says at one stage that in order to love and to care for somebody else, what it really means is to say to them, in word and deed, it's good that you are here. I'm glad that you exist. Excuse me, sorry, blow your ears out. It's good that you're here. I'm glad that you exist. And I like that. I like that because that's kind of like the exact opposite of the way in which many people within our society think about people with dementia. Because the general thrust, certainly here in Europe, you can work out what it's like in New Zealand, is that it's not good that you are here. I'm not glad that you exist. You know, in Europe it's complicated because we now have, in some countries, euthanasia for people with dementia. But as soon as you get a diagnosis of dementia, you can go to your family doctor and ask to be euthanized, not because of necessarily anything immediate, but because of the fear of the future. So what I've tried to suggest to you today is that actually there may be a more hopeful way to look at that, that we don't need to think in these negative terms. And actually that phrase, expression, it's good that you're here, I'm glad that you exist, might be the beginning point for genuinely person-centered spiritual care for and with people living with dementia. So, thank you for listening.